All right. Well, I apologize. As you can see, the projector doesn't seem to be, it's giving me a problem this morning. I got here a little later than I usually do, but plenty of time to get set up. And then I look up and I thought that had come on and it hadn't. And I don't want to waste a lot more time fooling with it. So what we're going to do is, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to show you the pictures right now or be able to write anything for you right now. So what you'll have is my golden oration, all right, at the moment. And then what I will do, though, is very shortly after class, I will type up what I would have written and with the pictures, same smart board I would have created in class, and I'll share it with you up on the website like I do all of them, okay? And like I say, not quite sure what's happening there, but in any case, we'll get you the material later than sooner. All right, now we are going to have a test a week from today. I just said all happened so fast, right? And I've been getting some questions from folks, you know, what about the reading, you know, and what about, are you going to do, you know, have some kind of test prep for us or practice sheet? And the answer to the latter is no. You've got the material I've presented, you've got the audio of the lectures, you've got the smart boards, and you have your textbook, and you just need to be able to prepare from that material. But you can use some hints. So here's a few tips. The readings are listed, the chapters required that will be covered are listed on the syllabus. The entire chapter that I list is required. However, there are parts of it that are probably pay you to study a little more deeply. Or at least let's put it this way. The way I would do it, I would read the chapters, and then when I, in advance of the test, the day before the test, I would thumb back through the chapters and look at what? Look at tables and figures and major headings, you know, boldface type headings, and say, okay, do I remember what these are supposed to be telling me? And with that type of study, you can hope to get a number of the book questions. Remember, there's going to be 30 questions, and there'll be about a third of them from the book. Okay, maybe 25 questions. I better take that back. I forget exactly how many, but whatever I give you, there'll be about a third of them from the book, two-thirds from the lecture. Now, also remember, when you see your grade, that's your test grade, yes, but you also have a clicker grade, and the clicker points are just like test points. All I do at the end of the term is add test 1, test 2, test 3, and all your clicker points into one big number and divide by 300. That's your percentage that gives you your letter grade. So that means that if you're bringing in 10 or 12 points into the test from the clicker, and almost everybody that's registered a clicker has that many points, because remember, I'm giving you back the three lowest are going to come back at threes at the end of the term. So even if you've got a slow start on this clicker business, you still got some clicker points. Almost a whole grade letter worth of clicker points. So, you know, if you look and you say, oh, that test grade was a little low, after you get it back, you say, oh yeah, I get to add on those clicker, and then it looks better, right? That's what the clicker's all about. Now, having said all of that, there's going to be folks, I see it every year, that have been here every day and that read the book and that study diligently, and then they get their test back and it's like a 62 or something, and they're real disappointed. I think that happens with sometimes with folks. This is a non-science elective for non-science majors, isn't it? A lot of you are not science majors. There's the reason that you're not science majors. Some of you are, and that's fine. But the ones that aren't science majors, you know, maybe the problem is you don't think like a scientist, most likely. We're trying to kind of get you a little bit in that direction with this course, but unfortunately I do think like a scientist, and I make up test questions like a scientist. And so some of you, no matter how much you study, it seems to be almost impossible for you to predict what I'll put on the test. So how do you get around that? There's one surefire way, and it's the only thing that really probably helps a lot of people bring up their grade. And you might as well start doing it with the first test. And that is a study group. Join a study group. If you're at all anxious about your grade, join a study group. Because somebody in that study group, several people in that study group, are going to get it. They're going to kind of know what to expect. You maybe don't. That's just the way your mind works, and that's just going to be a frustration for you. But if you get in a study group and they say, well, these are the kinds of things I think we need to be talking about, and they'll probably be on the test, you say, oh, really? You know? But yeah, really. And so that's where that cross-fertilization of opinions is really helpful. So with the Blackboard feature and the emails and everything, it's pretty easy to come up with study groups, and that's what I would suggest you get into. And if you don't join a study group and you're disappointed with your grade, all I'm going to say when you come up and say, I'm disappointed with my grade, I'm going to say, did you join a study group? And that'll help. Okay, so next time, Thursday, we're going to have the last lecture of this section on my favorite topic, fish. And also, back to the point of the test, I will show you somehow, assuming the projector's working, but we'll show you one way or the other. I will show you as an in-class special and a test question, not an example test question, not one that it'll be like this, an actual question off the test. So if you want to get that test question and see exactly a question that's going to be on there, and hell, that's one question you'll get right, all right? So be here on Thursday, and we'll share that with you, as well as complete our last material for the lecture. I don't suppose this has magically come back alive or anything here. Yeah, son of a gun. Okay. No. That's just taunting me up there. Okay, so what we're going to talk about today is, we talked about the raptors, we talked about the game birds, we talked about the mammalian predators last week, and today we're going to talk about the mammalian prey animals, or game mammals. And there's a lot we could talk about, but the big ones are the deer family. Okay? There's four principal North American deer we're going to talk about. What are those? Who can tell me the deer? White-tailed deer in the eastern U.S. What's another? Mule deer in the west. What's another? Oh, okay. Black-tailed deer. That's not a major. He's right. There's a black-tailed deer out on the west coast. Elk. American elk. Right. And the fourth. Moose, the largest of the deer. So those are the four deer we're going to talk about. So let's start with the white tail. Well, you know, this kind of frees me up. I don't have to write anything down today, right now anyway. And so I can wander around and be amongst you. Oh boy, you say, my lucky day. But the white tail deer is the native deer to the east of the Great Plains and wooded eastern North America. From Florida north to into southern Canada. And the white-tailed deer is a kind of quintessential game animal, isn't it? It's the rack of horns on the male and the fall hunting season and all this kind of stuff. Now, the white-tailed deer is an excellent example of one of these animals that we've talked about, wild animals, that has cycled depending on what people do. So if you go back, as I often do, to early settlement times in North America, you'll find that there's some population of white-tailed deer. We don't know exactly what it was, but we would consider it, compared to today's population, moderate. It would probably be fewer deer existed in pre-Columbian America than exist today in North America. Now, that didn't last for long, because as settlers moved across the continent and began to do the deforestation for subsistence agriculture, and then later they did the cutting of the trees for the lumber and then feed the Industrial Revolution. More on that next time. But as they did so, and they fanned out across eastern North America, they really put the pressure on a lot of the megafauna, the big animals. We've already talked about what happened to the eastern cougar, or the eastern black bear, or the gray wolf back east, or the red wolf back east. And they also put the hurt on the whitetail. Not that they were afraid of the whitetail, one of these predator frightened things, but what it was that they were good to eat. And they were hungry, and they were subsistence hunters as well as subsistence farmers. And they ate what they were able to grow and what they were able to shoot. And the whitetail was out there. There were no regulations. There were no game seasons. You were just got the deer if you needed a deer, and you could find one. Well, this intense hunting pressure, accompanied with the clearing of the forest and making the very exposed kind of habitat for the deer. They were right hanging out there and getting shot. Well, the population by the mid-20th century, say 1950, by the time I was born, the population of eastern whitetails was tiny compared to what it had been or what it is now. For example, it is estimated that in 1950, that there were only 2,000 white-tailed deer left in Tennessee. 2,000. Hell, there's 2,000 whitetails killed in Hickman County every year now, right? We got lots more deer than that. So what happened? Well, the whitetail, in one of the great successes of game and fish agencies across this nation, they brought the whitetail back. It wasn't just Tennessee, they were down to just a handful. All across the East, it was the same. Yeah, there were some big old antlered bucks out there because the ones that survived had all the habitat and food that they wanted. But there weren't just that many out there anymore. And people just didn't much go deer hunting back in, because in 1950, because there weren't that many deer to kill. And so what happens? The game and fish agencies of all the eastern states begin a process of bringing back the whitetail. How do they do that? Well, they go and find the pockets that still have the whitetail present, and then they begin to move the whitetails into areas where they're gone. There's great swaths, great of counties in Tennessee in 1950 where there are no deer. Can you imagine that now? No deer. And they begin to introduce those deer. The first few years they're out there, they protect them. They don't allow hunting. They allow the population to build. When the population in the new reintroduced area begins to get bigger, they take some from that and move them to a new place and move them to a new place. And this goes on for 30 years all across the eastern United States. I think the Tennessee Wildlife Resources did their last deer relocation program for whitetails in the early 80s. And that was then success. The whitetails were back. Whitetails now in every county in Tennessee and every county across the east. And at numbers of whitetails that exceed pre-Columbian estimates, most likely. And so what we've seen is the white-tailed deer go through this decline and rebirth with the help of humans, with the help of humans on both. We knocked them out and we brought them back. Now, one of the things that helped bring them back was that deer are not really deep forest animals. They're not the passenger pigeons of the animal kingdom, okay? They like, and if I had my, and I'll write it when I get my, type up your notes, but they are browsing animals. The word browse. What does that mean? That means they eat on things like tips of bushes and shrubs. So let's imagine what level of plant succession, remember you read about plant succession in the text? What level of plant succession provides a lot of browse? Not the big climax forest, not the agricultural field particularly, though they will raid soybeans or something if they get a chance. That's just too tempting. But the mid-succession, kind of edge areas, like so many wildlife like. And when a lot of the old farms and stuff were growing up, this provided wonderful habitat for whitetails. And whitetails continue to do well in areas where succession has been artificially lowered for a while. Like, for example, in a clear cut, in a forested area. You'll find more deer in an old clear cut than you will in the forest prior to harvest of those trees. Because as that forest grows back up, it provides a lot of browse and a lot of food for whitetail. Okay, so the next deer we want to talk about, we're going to move on out west and talk about the mule deer. Now, there's a theme I've brought up before where the eastern animals, especially the big ones, like the cougars and the deer and what have you, are under a lot more pressure than the western animals. Because why? Because there's a lot more people back east and there are a lot more people earlier back east. Yes, if you go to California, there's a lot of people. But still, to this day, if you go to places like Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, there's not just a whole lot of human population density compared to someplace like Tennessee or Pennsylvania, right? And so the western deer, the mule deer, which is called a mule deer because of its big ears, like a mule, it's a bigger, heavier, more solidly built animal than the whitetail. Otherwise, they're superficially very similar. I have pictures when I get to slides up. And these mule deer then have never had the great decline and rebuild that the whitetail went through. Because they never had the population pressure that came in wholesale and lived in every square mile and shot them on sight and cleared the land and this and that. So they've had just less to deal with humans, and so their population has not fluctuated as much. The third deer I want to talk about is the American elk, and it's a big animal, bigger than a mule deer, certainly bigger than a whitetail, and the American elk is found currently in the Intermountain West, quite widely distributed, but also found, back east in a few spots. Kentucky has built a good elk population. When I was a kid and read like Field and Stream about elk and elk hunting, my perception was elk, like mule deer, were a western U.S. animal, western North American animal. Where people saw elk and where people went elk hunting, for example, were places like Colorado. Right? That's where you went, up into the high mountains, out west, to the Rockies. But that was not, the range of the elk was not restricted to the mountain west. That's just kind of where they were left after people came through. Elk, and like bison, we don't really have a formal presentation on bison in this class, American buffalo, but bison were thought of as, you know, Great Plains animals. But they were back in Tennessee and through the east, and so were American elk. Elk are native animals to Tennessee. But talk about shot out early. While the whitetail were going, the elk went. And they were completely extirpated. Remember that word? I'll remember to type that on the notes as well. But extirpation, I think I've introduced you to that word, is a regional extinction. American elk are not extinct in North America, or extinct from the world. but they are, have been extirpated from many places in the East. And so now, why don't we just bring them back to the East like we brought back the whitetail, right? Like we brought back the eagles, like we brought back the raptors. Why don't we have a great success with American elk and bring them back to their native areas in the East? And the reason is, well, we're trying. But some reintroductions are easier than others. The problem with reintroducing elk back east is basically a disease problem. They get, and again, I will type this into the notes, so don't freak out, but you know, when you get this smart board, you'll see, get all these words spelled out for you. The American elk are very vulnerable to a parasite called a meningeal worm. Anybody know what the meninges is? Do you have meninges? If you do, you're not talking about them, are you? What's a meninge? You're looking at me.
I know the disease that you're talking about.
Where does the disease occur?
It's a neurological disease that causes them
right.
to operate.
Very good. Where's the worm found?
In the brain.
In the brain. And that tells us something about the meninges. The meninges, and these guys are exactly right, but just to say where the meningeal worm's name came from, the meninges is the tissue covering the brain, kind of the skin of the brain. If you'd have cut the top of your head off and lift the skull cap, you'd have your glistening brain. And if you poked it with a probe, there'd be a kind of a tough little tissue on the outside. My mother used to buy calf brains at the store and make brains and eggs, okay? You don't do this much anymore. It's kind of fallen out of favor, especially with things like, you know, chronic wasting disease and mad cow disease and things like that. But in any case, I remember she would take these calf brains and wait to prepare them to cook, would peel the meninges off, kind of like skinning a catfish. Not quite like that, but you know. But anyway, the worms actually live on in the meninges of the brain. And as you could imagine, they have a profound effect on the neurological processing of this poor deer. Now, here's where things get complicated. White-tailed deer also are infected with meningeal worms. But white-tailed deer have adapted to their parasite. They become hosts for the parasite that are minimally affected by the parasite. You know, as evolution, one of the great lessons of evolution in terms of parasite-host interaction is that when a new novel parasite finds a novel host, typically the parasite is very deadly and kills the host quite rapidly. But then as time goes on and they evolve together, the parasite doesn't really want to kill the host all that, you know, he wants to have a host. If he kills it, it doesn't have a host anymore. So there's kind of a mutual selection pressure to attenuate the virulence of the parasite. And over time, these animals can then coexist. Now, in the case of the meningeal worm, it infects nearly every white-tailed deer out east, and the white-tail could care less. They don't even affected by it. And you can go out west and find an unaffected white-tail. They're not supposed to be out there, but they've got them in deer parks and stuff, and they seem to have the same neurological functioning of an infected white-tail. However, not so the elk. The elk are very much affected. Now, that's one reason the elk have not come back east and not been reintroduced back east, because out west, there are no meningeal worms. And so the elk are not infected. You bring them back east, the meningeal worm is seeded into the environment by the whitetail. And then the elk pick it up. And then the elk are debilitated. They get kind of like an Alzheimer's disease and they wander around in a stupor and die. So there was real question of whether elk could be reintroduced to the east with this meningeal worm threat. But in fact, what we have found is that yes, a meningeal worm has a deleterious effect on the population of the elk. It kills a bunch of them. But with proper management and proper regulation of hunting and what have you, you can reestablish elk populations. We know that, don't we? Because we now have, like I say, a good elk population up in Kentucky. We have a good elk, or smaller, but seems well-established elk population in the National Park and Great Smokies and the Cataloochee side. We have elk to a lesser extent, but still kind of coming on, kind of fed from the Kentucky population a little bit, up in what's on, if you drive up I-75 toward Kentucky, that big Cumberland wilderness all around you called Royal Blue Wildlife Management Area up there, that's where we have some elk outside of the park in Tennessee. And we're slowly beginning, though it's been a rough go, between the meningeal worm and frankly poaching. People poach the elks here in Tennessee, and it's a problem. But up in Kentucky, they've had a real success with reestablishing the elk, and they actually have elk seasons. Not something we're to the point of here in Tennessee. You know, last time we talked about the bears, and I talked about the bluff charge and the human-bear interactions and all of that. And I wanted to tell you about when I had a bad experience with a bear. But between the little film clip and all of that, I kind of ran out of time. So I thought I would have a little bear interlude here amongst the mammals, if you didn't mind, and tell you about, remember my cabin? I got to show you pictures of the cabin. But anyway, remember my cabin up in New Mexico? Okay. Well, this is way back in the 60s. When my family would go up there, my mother, my father, my sister, and I, and we would go up to the cabin and spend like weeks at a time in the summer, because my father taught school, was a professor, and he was able to get the summers off, and we'd go up there and have this wonderful experience in the mountains, you know, cutting our own firewood, carrying the water from the spring, crapping in the outhouse. What a wonderful experience for a young man. Okay. And right over the mountain from us is a New Mexico ski resort called Red River, New Mexico. And in Red River, back in the 60s, and this would be in the mid-60s, they had a problem bear. A bear that had been spoiled, a bear that had been fed human food and no longer would forage on his own, but would just harass people to get food from them. Now, back in the old days, we've come a long way in how to handle problem bears. But back in the old days, they would simply, this bear was breaking into screen porches and trying to get into trunks of cars and dumping over garbage and all of that. So the wildlife officers, New Mexico Game and Fish, darted the bear, loaded him up in a, you know, cage, and carried him all the way up to where he would not find people to harass, which happened to be not very far away from Red River, just over the divide into our little creek, the Cabresto, and all the way up to Cabresto. Now, true enough, where they dumped the bear, there were no cabins. But the bear only had to come down about 6 or 8 miles down the road and discover the cabins where our cabin was, right? So one Sunday, this bear wakes up hungover, head throbbing, you know, wanting a hot dog bad, and starts coming down the road wishing he could find a cabin. And lo and behold, he finally gets to our little inholding, and there's all these cabins. So he's just real excited. Now he knows, he's already learned that there's no point going to a cabin without a car. So he looks for a cabin with a car, and sure enough, our neighbor's there. The bear sees the car in front of the cabin, knows there's people there, runs up to the door and begs, you know, just begs like a dog, scratches on the door. Big old bear, you know, 300-pound bear. And so the people, you know, idiots. They had caught a bunch of trout out of the little stream. So they crack open the screen door and flip trout out there. Of course, a bear loves that, man. He hadn't eaten in 3 or 4 days. He slurps those trout down just like oysters on a half shell or something. And then he, wants more. That's one thing about feeding a bear. You don't have enough. You never have enough. And so they ran out of trout. Okay, bear, go away, go away. Well, the bear doesn't go away. Arr, he just gets more insistent. So they close and lock the door. Hope you'll go away. So he then, after about 30 minutes, they don't come back and feed him more trout. He sees our cabins just right over here, 100 feet away. So he notices we're home. We've been peering out the window at all this activity. And so here comes a bear. You know, what can I get over here, guys? And he starts coming up to our door and begging and scratching. And the right at that point, right as we're going, shoo, bear, we don't got food, you know, we noticed that you never saw anybody load a car as fast as our neighbors did. And they jump in the car and roar off down the dirt road, see you next weekend, maybe. And they went back to Albuquerque. And we were alone in the canyon with this damn bear. And so, of course, we stayed in the cabin. We didn't dare feed it. And the cabin, and the bear just sat there and got madder and madder and madder. And he would kind of, you know, circle the cabin and sit up in the woods. And we didn't know what to do. We didn't dare go to the outhouse. We crapped in the chamber pot, which is a pretty grim way to go. And went to bed hoping the bear would get bored and go on downstream away from us, right? Well, we were all sound asleep when we hear this, you know. Wow, what the shit? We jump up. You wondered why I put that chair there, didn't you? We jump up and we run out. Not out, but we run down. We run out of our bedrooms to the front room there and look out the window. And there on the porch, there's a porch, a deck, right there in front of our two main kind of picture windows looking at the mountain. And the bear's got up, he's got up on the deck and he's pissed. He's looking for food and he's looking seriously for food. And he threw the chairs off the deck, threw the table off the deck. He goes around the house again. He finds the crawl space under the house. He goes under the house. We can hear him. Boom, 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 boom. Throwing shit around under the cab, bumping on the joists of the house. And we're, you know, we're just terrified of what's he going to do. But we think, well, maybe, he, you know, we're in the house. He's outside of there. Then he comes back on the deck. We got these little shitty, you know, cabin windows with little rusty screens on them. It would be nothing for that bear to come through that window. And it occurs to the bear. He knows we have food in that house. So he puts his paws up on that window and presses his nose against that screen and growls, rawr, and looks in there and tries to see what kind of food we must have. So at that point, my father springs into action with the family self-defense plan, okay? And remember, this is the guy that threw the bullets in the fire. Okay, you're in swimming there. Let's don't get our hopes up for the self-defense plan. But in any case, he puts my mother and my sister on the front lines and arms them with flashlights. All right? So they're standing up there on either side of the window. And he tells them, when the bear comes through, turn on the lights and shine it in his eyes and blind him. Okay. And then he gets the little shotgun. We have a little 410 shotgun. Remember I told you about the 410s. We have a little 410 shotgun. And so he says, he's trying to get that loaded. He's got a little thing of birdshot in there. And he finally gets the gun loaded. And he says, when he gets past you, I'll shoot him in the nose. You know. I mean, this would get the bear's attention, but I don't think in a good way, all right? Then he looks at me. I'm thinking, holy shit, what's my role in this disaster, you know? And he says, Richard, he says, you've been chopping wood all summer, and you're pretty good with that axe. And this is, I swear to God, he handed me the axe and said, when he gets past me, cleave his skull. No, no, I don't think so. You know, I could see the headlines the next day in the local paper. You know, look out for a one-eared bear with a bloody snout. You know, for the mauled family in Cabresto, right? So anyway, so here comes the bear, He breaks through the screen, comes, hits the glass, the lights flash on, my father's still fucking with the gun, I've got the axe. I'm going, no, Mr. Bear, please, Mr. Bear, don't do this to us. And he, sure enough, he saw the abject fear in my face probably, and he had a little merciful turn of heart, and he backed off. Or maybe the defense plan really worked, I don't know. But in any case, he left, wandered down the creek, and somebody else took a pot shot at him with a shotgun later on, run him off of their cabin, and last we had heard of him. But I can tell you one thing, that's the kind of bear that no good will ultimately come to, right? That's why you don't feed bears. So, anyway, sharpen up your axes there and take a break for a little bit, and we'll come back, finish up on moose. And I've got a clicker quiz for you. We need to get some more points for you prior to that test, okay? Yeah, let me, come on up. Hop, just the stairs down there, come on up. I gotta put this chair back. Oh, I think my battery ran out along the way.
It was the summer before college started, and so my parents and I, we were gonna stay a week before orientation up in the Smokies.
Uh-huh.
We ran out of battery. And, before I left, I was telling my friend in my neighborhood this, and she goes, well, would you like to borrow my bear spray? She's going to see a bear.
Right, right.
And so thanks for offering, but I doubt what I've seen. And like, we kind of just snow her off for it, and we're like, I doubt we're never going to see any bears, but we get up there, and we see some, and it looks like a statue, it's just standing so still. We go, hello, they have a little black bear statue welcoming us.
This was at the cabin, right?
This is at the cabin. And we're like, oh, that's cute. And then
that's so cute.
Then we drive to our cabin and we go, that statue just moved. That's not a statue. That was the first one we saw. Then later on that day, we saw four or five more. Oh. We saw a mama bear and two cubs.
Oh, wow. And you kind of wish you'd got that bear spray.
I
huh?
told my friend, go, we should have gotten that bear spray. But the best one was my mom and I were out shopping, and my dad was just outside reading a book on the swinging porch. And he's reading it, and he hears something behind him. He looks up, he slowly turns around, and there's this big black bear just sitting there, like, looking up at him. So he just goes, he says, I just got up, closed my book, walked to the door.
Well, that's the thing to do.
So
he did it right.
Slowly walked up. And locked that damn door. I'm afraid I didn't see that damn thing again.
That's a good story.
Hey, Dr. Strange, I was going to ask you.
Yes, sir.
I've been in the Teleco Mountains since I was like 6 months old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we got a cabin up there.
Right
there. We're about 5 miles from the state line.
Okay.
North Carolina. And we hadn't had much problems until lately. And I mean, there's a couple people that live up there all year long, you know, and we go up every weekend pretty much.
Right.
And here, like, in the past 3 weeks, there's been 8 dogs killed. And so, like, and I'm not talking about, like, little dogs, like pit bulls and rottweilers killed. And my 2 dogs, we're not letting them outside anymore unless we're, like, got them in the leash, you know?
Right. I guess so, not.
There's only 2 dogs left up there. And this, I mean, they've been up there for, they're 9 and 10 years old, and like, we've never had any problems like this.
Uh-huh.
And so we started looking around. We thought that, okay, like maybe hogs or something.
Right.
Because we have a lot of hogs up there, but we couldn't find any like rut marks or anything.
Right.
And so I didn't know if you knew something, because we're still trying to figure out, and the guys that live up there, you know, that have been there for 60 years, they don't know what it is either. And the, I don't know what the TWRAs or the USWF is what to do.
Right,
To look at it. But I mean, that's like, see, that's 8 or 9 dogs in 3 weeks. That's a lot. you know. And it's pretty bad deaths. Like the first one we found was right on our driveway, and it was ripped in half. The dog was ripped in half.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
That's awful.
And I mean, one of the dogs up there that's still alive, I mean, he's been in contact with a bear like 2 times. I mean, he's only got one ear, and, you know, he's got scars, and he's tough. You know, he got mauled pretty bad on his face.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We don't know what it is. But.
Well, I'd say it's bears. It's the most likely, don't you?
I mean, we have bears, but we've never had like anything that bad happen with them, because I mean, when my brother was 3 years old, he pet a bear. We were sitting by the campfire, and the bear came up, so he started petting it. We didn't know where he was, so we turned around. So I mean, we have bears all over the place, but we haven't had anything like that happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't know if you'd seen anything like.
Oh no, well, yeah, that sounds like bears to me.
Yeah. I mean,
unless you think it's coyotes getting them.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, those are pretty big dogs, you know. And you said they don't really hunt in packs. I've never seen them in packs, so.
Yeah, if it's a big dog, probably. Not. All right. All right, guys. Well, let's get back started here. And, you know, it occurs to me, I'm a real quick study, you know. I don't have a projector working today, and so I'm thinking, how am I going to do the clicker quiz? You know, y'all could click, but what would you know to click at? So I think really probably the sensible thing to do, I've got the question I was going to give you today, and I apologize this isn't working. I'll call tech support and get the video working for next time. And so next time, not only will I give you that test on the question on the test, but I'll also give you your last clicker quiz before the second test, first test. So I'm sorry, my intention was to give it to you today, and if you brought your clickers, good for you, just bring them Thursday, okay? And I apologize, I just, you know, this, I don't know what the deal is. So let's finish up then on the moose and the biggest of the deer family. You may not realize that, but the moose is considerably larger than even a big bull elk. Big bull moose, and moose are associated, as you may kind of understand, with the northern tier of states, and they were never as far south as Tennessee, right? Moose are the animals of the Maine forest, right, of the Great Lakes states, and then of Yellowstone, and on across the west there, and into southern Canada, so, and all the way up into Alaska is moose territory. So they are a northern deer member. And they're also different from any of the other deer. All the other deer are browsers. If I may digress. Hell, I'm the professor. Damn well I'm going to digress. What I'm going to tell you is what I meant to tell you about the American elk, because I was about to talk about browsing. And the American elk, while both the mule deer and the whitetail are good browsers, the American elk is the one member of the deer family that tends to be more of a grazer. Okay? Will take more grass. They'll certainly browse to some extent. But also, the other thing I forgot to tell you about the American elk, I got all into the meningeal worm, and then I wanted to tell you about the bear, but the American elk out west goes through what we call an altitudinal migration. You know about birds. Birds go through what we call a latitudinal migration. They move up and down in latitude, north and south, with the seasons. North in the summer, south in the winter, typically like a waterfowl, a duck. We all know about that. To kind of match themselves to the preferred climate. Now, you also know that going up in elevation is like going up in latitude. It gets colder. You can go up, and that's why the great top of the Great Smokies right here in Tennessee is part of the Great Northern Forest. It's also found up in southern Canada and Maine. So that is going up in altitudes like going up in latitude. So it may not surprise you that American elk out west undergo not a latitudinal migration, but an altitudinal migration with season. What does that mean? That means that the American elk will move from the lower mountain valleys of the West in the winter. And when the summer comes and the snows leave the high country, they'll move up above timberline, up into tundra areas with the ptarmigan and all of that. And so a lot of times we think, if we think of elk at all, at these high timberline areas. Those are their summer habitats. Obviously, when it gets cold and you have dumped snow and it's at 12,000 feet, nothing much is going to stay up there. And so they come on down. They all come on down to the lower elevations, a few thousand feet down. They migrate down so they get less snow, warmer areas to overwinter. Now the problem has been, prehistorically, this altitudinal migration worked great. Now, in modern times, today, the high altitude places, the timberline places, are still okay. The summer range is pretty much intact. Nobody lives up there, human-wise. But when they come down to 9,000 and 10,000 feet to find a mountain valley to overwinter in, what do they find? They find people, they find ranchers, they find ski resorts, they find right outside of Yellowstone, right there on the Snake River, Grand Tetons and all of that. What's that town?
Jackson.
Jackson Hole, thank you. Jackson Hole, Wyoming. They come down. Jackson Hole, Wyoming was a prime overwintering habitat for the elk. And now what do they find? It's all full of people all winter long. And so where are they supposed to go? And so what do the elk do? Well, the elk end up then, you know, having to squeeze into little corrals and get fed hay. Sometimes in the winter, you'll see these shots from Jackson Hole where they have these, you know, herds of elk all crammed up just because they got to put them someplace. And the habitat of the elk is no longer there in the winter for them. All right, now back to the moose. What got me going to remind you that the elk were a little bit more grazers than browsers. The moose are browsers, but they're different than the deer in that they are aquatic plant browsers. Moose are very much associated with the aquatic habitat. When I finally get my slides uploaded and you can see what I would like to be showing you now, you'll see a moose standing in a marshy area up to his belly in the water. That's typical moose habitat. They like wet areas and they browse on wet plants. Now, the moose are very big animals and get up, you know, 6 feet high at the shoulder, big boom moose and stuff like that, weigh thousands of pounds, and there's not much that can hurt an adult moose. But a sick moose, a baby moose, a moose with a female with a calf is vulnerable to predation from gray wolves. Packs of gray wolves are able to take down anything other than the strongest moose. And in fact, moose are a favorite prey item of the gray wolf. And I want to tell you a little story, and I've got, again, illustrations on my slides that you'll want to review. But there's a national park up as an island in Lake Superior, the biggest Great Lake, right up there. In fact, it's closer, this island, this U.S. National Park, is closer to Canada than it is to the U.S. Does anybody know the name of the island national park in Superior? Yeah, Isle Royal. And Isle Royal was made a national park in the early part, about 1940. Now, if we look at the history of moose and wolves on Isle Royal, what we'll find is that sometime in the last couple hundred years, back around 1900 or prior to that, we're not exactly sure, moose came across the ice, the winter ice, from Canada one time and and began to live on Isle Royal. Now, Isle Royal is a big island, but like any island, it really shows the effect of animal overpopulation. Because usually, when animal populations get too big, right, and they start running out of food, what do? Before they die, they leave. They take a hike. They look for some better places. But if you're on an island, you can't leave. You're stuck. And so you see vividly, humans see vividly the effect of animal overpopulation on island habitats. And so what began to happen with the moose in the early 1900s after they established themselves is you would have these boom and bust periods of moose populations. And moose are not alone in having booms and busts in population based on carrying capacity. All the deer family do this. When a deer family expands, any of the deer family, whether you're talking about white-tailed deer or elk or moose, can expand their population very rapidly if they have the habitat resources. But then they end up overshooting the carrying capacity and producing more animals than the habitat can support. And at this point, they destroy the habitat. They kill the plants. And they actually reduce the carrying capacity by eating the plants off to the roots. They establish what's called a browse line. You can walk through a habitat that has an overpopulated deer population and you can see a line, depending on whether you're talking about whitetail or moose, it may be 8 feet up, it may be 10 feet up, whereas the highest that the tallest deer on tippy toes can reach and tear leaves off of trees and what have you. And everything else down to the ground is chewed to crap, right? They've eaten all the way up as far as they can reach. That's called a browse line. And that means they've really erupted. The population has erupted and had this big population spike that is over the carrying capacity. Now, what happens next? Well, if they're on an island like Isle Royale, they can't leave, right? So what do they do? They get sick, they starve, they parasite loads become higher, and the old hand of nature takes its course, and they suffer and die in huge numbers. And the population crashes. And it'll go down way below the original carrying capacity. They die off because they all get sick and starved. And then what happens? Slowly the vegetation comes back. Slowly the deer population or the moose population comes back. And then what happens? It erupts again. And you can, and what we saw on Isle Royale is every decade, to 10 to 20 years, we'd see a moose eruption and then a crash. In the process, destroying temporarily the habitat. And so when the National Park was formed in 1940, the park rangers thought, you know, this is not a good scene, right? This is a one-sided view of nature. Normally, you'd have both moose and wolves, predator and prey. But just because of being this island out in the middle of the lake, the moose got here, but the wolves aren't here. So what we'll need to do is put some wolves here. Now this was way back, like I say, 1940. This was back before we knew about reintroducing red wolves and hacking eagles. The biologists didn't really know what they were doing. So what did they do? They went and got some basically zoo wolves from Bronx Zoo because they were there, and they got them, and they turned them loose on Isle Royale with all these moose. Well, these zoo wolves had been in captivity for several generations. They were used to being hand-fed by people. This is why you don't let people see the wild animals you're trying to get back into the wild. But they already started out with basically tame wolves. And so what happened? The wolves said, ooh, icky, a moose. They're not going to eat a moose. They're looking for kibble, right? And they know people have that. So what do? What the recreation on Isle Royale is, and you can do this, is you go to Canada, the easiest route, and you get a ferry over to Isle Royale, and they drop you off with your pack, and you hike around on the island for a while, and then you have a pickup period. These are true wilderness experience. Well, so the hikers that were hiking around on Isle Royale pretty soon find these damn Bronx Zoo wolves following them around and getting a little testy when they wouldn't give them their food. And so these wolves are then becoming a threat to the humans, very similar to a spoiled bear. And so obviously that was not working. So the Park Service takes a moose back off, and they're scratching their head about what to do next. to control this, I mean, not the moose, the wolves, excuse me, and what to do about this moose population, when, so happens, about the same time, within a few years of the zoo wolf experiment, a pack of wild wolves comes across the ice in the winter and volunteers, you know, we're here. And what do? They very quickly begin to have this predator-prey interaction with the wolves. Now, this doesn't keep, I mean, with the moose, this doesn't keep the population level, dead level. It still oscillates. But what's interesting, and I have a graph that I'll put up with my slides. I also have some photographs showing the moose on Isle Royale hunting. I mean, the moose hunting. This thing, working without slides, kind of like working without a net on a trapeze, right? The wolves, I've got pictures showing the wolves taking down the moose, aerial photos. It's pretty vivid on Isle Royale. And I also got a graph that shows the population increase and decrease with what the way it is. Take a look at this graph. The moose start to do their eruption thing when the population of wolves is low. And then the population of wolves begins to increase with this increasing food supply right behind the wolves. It's offset. And then when the wolves get to a certain population, they begin killing off the moose sufficiently. The moose begin to come down and the wolves stay high until, whoops, they ran out of food too, and they come down and, you got offset oscillations. But it's still far less than the pre-1940 eruptions that destroyed big segments of the habitat on Isle Royale and let the moose die wholesale, okay? Much more predator-prey control type situation. And can't give you a test, so I gotta let you go. Come back next time, I'll get this thing working and we'll have it. And we'll show you a test question and we'll talk about fish. And I won't even knock a chair off the stage, maybe.
Mr. Strange.
Yes, sir.
I'll be headed out of town with the Marine Corps unit on Thursday, or tomorrow night, actually.
Okay.
We'll be back till next week on Monday.
Okay.
So I know I'll be missing the clicker quiz.
Right.
Which I was, if you need paperwork or whatever, I can get you that.
I'm totally sympathetic, as you can imagine, but I can't, I'm not going to get into doing an excuse clicker quiz. Remember, for this very reason, you get your three lowest scores turned into threes, right?
You do, they get what?
Okay. Look on a syllabus, but what I'm going to do, you'll get a zero on Thursday because you're not here.
Okay.
I will go, at the end of the class, before I calculate the final grades, I'll go back through everybody's clicker scores that have been clicking, you know, that has a clicker, and I'll find the first three zeros, or ones if you don't have any zeros,
right?
And turn that into a three. Three mid. So you get three free absences, is what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Either if you're not absent, or you just fuck up and get the wrong question, I turned a one into a three. But if most people have some absences.
Okay.
So you get three free absences, won't affect your maximum clicker score.
Oh, okay then.
So that's the way we'll do it.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Well, I'm just going back to like beginning, and you were saying how like the people that are really good in class come to class, and then